subject for this evening is rather more interesting, perhaps, than the title would indicate. And it requires a kind of orientation, which I believe will contribute to our knowledge on a number of religious subjects. The story of the Golden Legend and its author, Jacob de Voragine, belongs to the 13th century of the Christian era. The work and the man were strongly emphasized and influenced by the psychology of the time. The European culture was passing through what we now call the medieval period, a long and difficult time, distinguished rather for its reactionary tendencies than for any contribution to progress. The medieval European was a person of extremely limited education and an almost completely provincial attitude. His life was circumscribed by old patterns and beliefs and folklore to a degree that it is difficult for us to appreciate. The church could not be different from its own time. Its clerics were drawn from the available material of the day. And even those who ascended to relatively high positions in the ecclesiastical structure were men of very limited education and, in many instances, ability. We cannot therefore expect a great, mature philosophical work to rise from such conditions. We cannot even expect an outstanding literary production. We must recognize that the 13th century European depended almost entirely upon folklore for his moral instruction, for his ethical concepts of life, and for the fulfillment of his hungers for knowledge. Folklore at that time was derived from a number of different sources. Some European, some Near Eastern, and others North African. There was no clear effort to distinguish between the sources of material. They were heaped together. We have a few evidences of what might be termed the learned thinking of that time. And to our eyes, to our comprehension, the scene was most distressing. Yet we cannot say that there was not sincerity or dedication or a great longing to discover a better way of life or to attain a deeper understanding of the mysteries of religion. At that time in Europe, there was only one church. There were splinters in smaller areas, but the burden of Christianity rested with the development of the Catholic Church. And within this church were produced men who were to add greatly to the luster, not only of their faith, but of the arts, and to the great contributions that they made, we give natural homage. The story of the Golden Legend is essentially a martyrology. It was a kind of saint's calendar. And under each day of the year was a suitable sanctified name. It is obvious that Jacobus, who was a citizen of Genoa, was not too solid in his history. But in all fairness, we should point out that he admitted it. He tells us in his book when he is confused, and that is quite frequently, that he tried definitely to create an inspiring work that would contribute to the well-being of the faithful. As a result of his teachings and preachings, he was elected Archbishop of Genoa by the congregation, not by a political move, but by the natural fondness that the people held for him. After his death, he was beatified, but never canonized. But the Dominican order has special rights to venerate him and to accord him many of the dignities of a saint. The martyrology, or the golden legend, deals with saints. And the more we study this work, the more we recognize that the tradition preserved in hagiology is far more interesting and perhaps more stimulating than the average person believes. We think of a saint simply as a very good person within the orthodoxy of his church who has been elevated to sanctification by an elaborate ecclesiastical process. This was not actually true in old times. The primary qualifications for sanctification in the beginning were martyrdom and miracles. The distinguished and pious person who died for his religion was held to have a peculiar estate, superior to that of even the ordinary devout person. If, for one reason or another, the saint escaped martyrdom, then the proof of his sanctification lay in miracles. These miracles might be performed during his lifetime, or they might be recorded after his death. The more common process was that miracles should occur at his tomb, or that persons with various troubles praying to his honored name might find extraordinary relief from their miseries. These two general forms have still survived. And it is rather interesting to note that the golden legend, which is really a calendar of saints, was sufficiently popular in its own time to be perpetuated by nearly 500 manuscript copies. Of course, all this occurred before the beginning of printing. But so large a number testified to the great demand for the work. After the invention of printing, it passed through 150 editions, most of them comparatively early, however. An interest in the work began to decline with the Renaissance. At that time, humanism began to sweep the world, and men's attention was turned from matters of ancient religion to the pressing concerns of modern Reformation. The various versions of the golden legend, however, continue to appear. And a recent English translation was published in 1941 under the imprimatur of Francis Cardinal Spellman, which would indicate that the subject has not entirely lost modern interest, at least within the body of the church. I think that the first thing we learn from the golden legend is something about the personalities, natures, and qualifications of the early Saint Martyrs. The more we study this description, and a number of writers have remarked this point, which is not at all original with me, the more we realize that the saint really emerges as a transcendentalist. He is a magician. He is a sage. He was a seer. He worked miracles. He could transport himself invisibly from one place to another. He was able to appear in countless forms and to extend his ministry over inconceivable periods of time. When we are all finished with the general pattern, we see that there is a startling similarity between the saints of early Christendom and the wonder workers, magicians, yogis, and the arhats of Oriental religion. The saint, in many instances, was almost a complete parallel for the Buddhist arhat. He renounced the world. This he held in common with most religious groups. He practiced austerities. He gave up all physical honors and comforts. He sought only one thing, the grace of God. He proved his dedication by selfless service to others. And his miracles were nearly always performed for the benefit of the oppressed or the poor or the downtrodden. He held all the strange and wonderful powers that we associate with the Oriental Mahatma. Many of these sanctified persons were as eccentric and strange and difficult to comprehend as the old arhats of Zen. And I imagine, had we any kind of likenesses of them, they would indeed be equally a motley group of rich and poor, wise and simple, who had by one manner of effort or another had achieved that end which all well-disposed persons desire. That was the enrichment and fulfillment of eternal and internal resources. Now it is interesting to trace something of the beginning of the story of the saints, not as individuals, but as a type, which in one form or another has appeared in so many parts of the world. Where did the Christian idea of canonization come from? It did not come from the Old Testament. It was not a common policy of the Orthodox Jews of that time. We find no real trace of it in Greek culture, nor does it show, formally speaking, in any phase of Roman belief. We say, formally speaking, because there is one parallel that may be worth noting. And that was the process of the deification of Roman emperors. A Roman emperor, however, when he was deified, might have his likeness raised as a monument in the city, and he would receive popular veneration and adulation. Some emperors were deified during their lifetime. And so were some of the Macedonian kings of Greece. But in these instances, a deification was largely based upon some heroic incident. These emperors were not deified because they were good. They were deified because they were powerful. They were recognized as examples of the prevailing psychological standard of the time, where strength and, if necessary, cruelty, these were condoned and applauded if they led to ultimate victory. If they advanced the destiny of the state, all personal considerations were ignored. First, the deification of the emperors, either of the Latin or the North African cultures, really does not cover our point, but it has a bearing on it, as we hope to demonstrate. The saint, as far as we can understand him, certainly appears to be an Oriental importation. The type of person that was venerated and canonized by the early church possessed those virtues that were most applauded among Eastern peoples. This does not mean that the good man would not have been regarded as good in his own country. He might have been greatly beloved. He might have been remembered with extraordinary fondness. But our saint is not just this good man. He was good according to the way of his time. And in many instances, he was certainly a spiritual hero. But he was more than this. He was wise. He was skilled. He was learned in many ways, mostly in the ways of mysticism and esotericism. These words, of course, were never used, but his attributes indicated this direction. So we might look a little bit to try and discover how it came about that about the first century A.D., this development of the idea of formal canonization, or the bestowing upon the venerated dead certain spiritual powers of intercession with God. To try to understand this a little better, we'll probably have to travel a bit to another part of the world. When Alexander the Great led his conquests into the East, he reached as far as what is now Pakistan. And then the continual dissensions of his armies and the desire of his soldiers to live, to return to their own homes, dissuaded him from further conquest. In what is now Pakistan, there developed a mingling of Greek and Indian culture, East Indian culture. This revealed itself by some, at least, semi-permanent cultural monuments. After Alexander had departed, these naturally fell into decline. There was nothing to maintain the Greek influence in Pakistan. But about the beginning of the Christian era, Pakistan, this area of it, and parts of Afghanistan became the outer boundaries of the Roman Empire. There was a communication between this area and Italy. Merchants traveled, artisans lived in Pakistan and perpetuated Roman customs, Roman arts. The peculiar mingling, therefore, of an Eastern tradition moving definitely westward and a Western culture moving relentlessly eastward resulted in a very interesting composite culture, which has come to be known as Gandhara. Gandhara was a province or country of no great political importance, part of which is now in Pakistan and part in Afghanistan. From the 1st to the 5th century, the Gandhara enjoyed an extraordinary flowering of art, particularly sculpturing and modeling. Gandhara, during this early period, in the latter part of the first and the early part of the second century A.D., also became a great stronghold of Buddhism. And the country was literally covered with monuments of Buddhistic thought, although Buddha himself had never actually journeyed through this region. In the early years of the second century A.D., as far as we can learn today, Gandhara produced the first human likeness of Buddha. Prior to that time, no effort had been made to represent this great Indian teacher as a person. He was represented only by symbols. Among these symbols was the wheel of the law, which has since been seen so often on the Soka's column, which has more recently become the official symbol of the Indian Republic. The second symbol associated with Buddha was the teaching chair, where he would be seated discoursing to his disciples. It was a low, throne-like structure, sometimes supported by lions. The third symbol peculiarly associated with Buddha at this period was the footprint, a device resembling the human foot, but usually larger, the sole of the foot being covered with an intricate pattern of symbolical designs. If it was therefore considered appropriate to represent Buddha, a congregation of the believers might be gathered about the teaching throne. Above the throne would be the chakra or wheel, and below the throne, on the ground in front, the footprints. This was all that was used to symbolize the great teacher. But in the rise of the Gandhara art, there gradually appeared the personification of the teacher. Modern archaeologists think of this by saying that here in Gandhara, the likeness of Buddha was first devised. The anthropomorphic process produced the physical embodiment of the unknown appearance. This physical embodiment itself is very interesting to us. Figures are usually standing, wearing a long and beautifully draped toga. The feet are sandaled, as in the type of sandal found in both Greece and Rome. The face is Grecian, very often with a straight nose with a high arch or bridge. The eyebrows are of Greek arch also. And the hair is arranged as in statues of the Apollo Belvedere, or the god of the sun. The only actually distinguishing peculiarities which would divide the Gandhara representation of Buddha from almost any other type of classical Greek or Latin sculpturing were the three peculiar symbols associated with Buddha as a person. One being the urna, or the small coil between the eyebrows, represented almost as a caste mark. The second was the usnisha, or the high protruding dome of the head. And the third was the elongated ears. These were about the only differences that could be found. The question arises, how did these peculiar attributes come to be incorporated immediately into the Gandhara likenesses, probably from the ancient scriptural descriptions found in the sutras? At this time, the Buddha was represented with long, wavy hair, either in a Greek form, or perhaps even suggesting the early hairdress of native Indian princes. At the top of the hair was arranged as a chignon, and there was none of the little tight curls that we see today. The figure was graceful, dignified, and when walking with a group of disciples similarly clothed, the Buddha very closely resembles a Greek philosopher or a Roman scholar. The bodily proportions are said to be largely of Roman extraction, belonging to a somewhat depraved art following the Roman adaptation of the Greek art. So the rather profane and unromantic archaeologist says that the original likeness of Buddha was a composition or composite of an Eastern deity, perhaps Krishna, a Grecian sun god, Helios or Apollo, and a deified Roman emperor. These were the contributing factors according to modern thinking. Whether this can be justified or not is hard to say, but we must realize that up to 100 years ago, Gandhara art was unknown. It was not discovered until that time. Now it is to be found in some of the choicest collections of the world. So, in the Gandhara carvings, Buddha is usually shown with a flat, simple nimbus. There is a halo behind the head. In general Asiatic art, bodhisattvas are also haloed. And in the Chinese and Indic schools of Buddhism, the arhats are haloed. The higher persons of this sublime hierarchy have more elaborate halos, such as the nimbus and the aureole, or the double halo. But with the arhats, it was almost always just a simple disc or circle surrounding the head. Where else is this halo to be found? Possibly in parts of India associated with the deities. Very little evidence of it anywhere in the Near East or in Europe. It would seem, therefore, that the artistic exchange between the Roman Empire and Gandhara may have strongly influenced the selection of the Buddhistic type for the identification of saints. There seems to be really no other way in which we can trace all the elements of the pattern. Now, if it be said that we are extravagant in this, there is one other point that stands out rather in an interesting way. In the Golden Legend, the 27th of November in the saint's calendar is assigned to the saint Josephet. A study of the account given in the Golden Legend is very interesting. For while it is highly Christianized, the facts seem to shine through. Once in a very distant region, not quite geographically identified, there was a king. And this king had an only son. And when this son was born to him, the wise men came and told the king that his son would either be a ruler of the world or a great teacher of mankind. The king, greatly disturbed at the possibility of his son taking religious orders, therefore built a palace. And here he kept his son away from all the common sights of mankind. Age, sickness, death were never seen by this young prince. He lived in luxury and wealth and joy and happiness. He made a very brilliant marriage to a very beautiful princess, and it seemed that his life was assured. But in this occasion, the saints, the angels, and of course, according to the golden legend, Christian teachers, reached this young man and revealed to him the sorrows of the world, how all worldliness was vanity, and why he should devote his life entirely to preaching the true faith. Under the influence of these teachers, the young prince renounced his kingdom, took off his princely robes, put on the costume of a monk, and became a teacher. Many wonderful conversions were made by him. He taught for a very great many years, and when the time came for him to die, he was taken up to heaven by the angels. Now, the sober scholars of the moment are inclined to feel that in some way Buddha himself got into the Christian martyrology. And I think it is only fair to point out that the Catholic Encyclopedia at the present time says that Josaphat is a corruption of Bodhisat, and that Saint Josaphat was Buddha. Now this is rather interesting, and some sources far more learned than the Encyclopedia have also come to the same conclusion. There seems to be no reasonable doubt that in some way Buddha attained canonization. If this occurred, there is no reason to doubt some rather definite connection between early Christianity and India. Now, we are not for a moment attempting to say that Christianity is a Hindu religion. Nothing of that nature is intended. What we are inclined to suspect, however, is that the original Christian communities cut off almost totally from the major streams of world progress of their time, most of them in isolated and desolate regions, founded by groups with little or no social standing, and for centuries almost continuously persecuted, that these communities lean heavily upon folklore for the legends and stories which gradually came to be included in the sacred canon of saints. They derived their heroes from anything that was heroic. And the peculiar similarity between the ritualism and sacerdotalism of Buddhism and Christianity has been a thorn in the flesh of missionaries ever since. A Buddhist country is one of the poorest areas to attempt to develop Christian missions. Not because of the antagonism of the people, but because of the immense similarity of the doctrines. There seems to most Buddhists no particular reason why they should be converted. Their own philosophy is almost identical. Now, if this experience occurred back at the beginning of the Christian era, it might explain a number of legends that even went down as far as the Middle Ages. The legends of the great Christian Empire of the East, for example, governed by John the Presbyter. It was believed that from the very earliest times, this great Christian empire had flourished somewhere in Gobi or in the northern Himavat, and that the teaching given to the people there was identical with Christianity. Well, Christian missions were not established that early, even though the Nestorians did reach China at a comparatively early date. So it's very possible that in Asia Minor there was a mingling of traditions and a meeting of minds. United already to Europe by the Silk Road, Asia was sending its silks and brocades to make garments for the Roman empresses. So the far places were not totally unknown. It is very possible that from the figures at Gandhara, and a little later, the rise of a more florid art of the same kind throughout northern, and particularly northwestern India, might well have provided the concept. For the old Buddhist monk, as represented in these carvings, wore the simple robes that we now associate with the apostles. He was shaven-headed. He carried a staff. He wore a monkish robe, very simple garments, sometimes bound at the waist by a cord, and behind his head was a disc of light. This is almost all that was required. And with the possible exception of the mingling of Eastern thought with the Egyptian tradition at a very early date, there seems to be no other convenient explanation for the rise of a design or pattern that appeared simultaneously in Asia and in Europe. That is the pattern of the holy man. In both areas, holiness led to extraordinary spiritual achievements. The transcendency achieved by the saint became the basis of a new kind of heroic being. Some of the philosophy of this may have been derived from the Greeks, but not the appearance. The Greeks also had their heroes. But again, the heroes were largely men of valor. And deification might come by the individual being picked out of the material world, carried to the heights of Olympus, there to mingle with the gods, and perhaps have his image or likeness translated to the stars. These legends existed. In the Greek initiation rituals, it is known that the hero represented the self-disciplined person, the individual who had transcended his own ignorance and had dedicated himself to the universal good of others. This dedication to the universal good certainly permeates the golden legend, although some of the expressions of it are extraordinarily crude. Another interesting possibility arises in the case of the sanctification of St. Catherine of Alexandria. Here again, we have almost certainly a pagan borrowing. From the story as found in the Golden Legend, we must be inclined to suspect that St. Catherine is nothing but a Christianizing of Hypatia of Alexandria. The brief description given in the Golden Legend clearly states that this, for them, Christian maiden was extremely learned in philosophy and the mathematics, was a great scholar, and was probably the most learned woman of her time. At that time, there was only one woman known in history that corresponded to such a title, and that was the daughter of Theon the mathematician, the head of the Neoplatonic school of Alexandria. She was the close friend of Bishop Synesius, who also had an interesting part to play in the strange mixing and minglings of early Christian and non-Christian traditions. Synesius was appointed bishop after the church had agreed to permit him to keep his wife and live with her. He refused to give her up, but they were in such desperate need of a good bishop in that region that they agreed to his, shall we say, eccentricity. Synesius also required that the church should say clearly at all times that the new bishop was a Christian in the performance of his duties, but that in his heart he would always remain a pagan. This they also agreed to do. They must have been right short-handed in those days. Synesius was a friend of Hypatia, and frequently consulted her on important matters of both religion and science. And it is said that through her assistance, he was able to produce advanced forms of water clocks and other means of measuring time. Now, the truth of the matter is, of course, that Hypatia never became a Christian. In fact, she was a pagan martyr who was killed by Christians. Here we have a case that is not too dissimilar, though not entirely parallel, with that of Jeanne d'Arc. In the case of Hypatia, she was dragged through the street by a frantic group of ignorant and bigoted monks. Her body was broken on the rack. She was beaten to death, and then the flesh was scraped from her bones with oyster shells. A little later, she emerges as St. Catherine. Changing of times, changing of thought. The early people undoubtedly had less theology but more humanity. They realized that any person who is willing to die a terrible death for their convictions has something of holiness in them. And they were a little less cautious in selecting their martyrs in those days. The legends of great and good people seem to have strongly influenced the thinking of that time. Now, we remember that the Golden Legend was compiled in the 13th century. Most of the accounts which it contains belong to the first 5 centuries of the Christian era. Therefore, between these events and kindly and well-intentioned Jacobus was an interval of over 700 years. 700 dismal years. Years without adequate history, without any proper alignment of events. Centuries of darkness, of ignorance and illiteracy, of the scatterings of people, when perhaps the only medium for the perpetuation of anything was the old wives' tales. They alone served as the basis of a communication. Now, at the time this was happening, two other elements appeared in Christian thinking, both of a very highly supernatural type. Ordinary folks had very little possibility of contemplating the natures of the archangels, but the angel became very important to them. The angel, as the minister of deity, as the servant of the Holy Trinity, was not only reminiscent of the Annunciation of Mary, but according to the old tales, angels always appeared in emergency. Somewhere along the way, the idea of the guardian angel came into existence, an idea that has never been officially recognized by the church, but is said to be of the mind of the congregation. Guardian angels were probably borrowed from Egypt, but they passed through a certain transformation, so that space, the invisible part of the world, became more or less the abode of these invisible ministers of the Almighty. Angelic forms appeared in art at a comparatively early date, and of course, the same general idea of angels was common throughout Asia and does occur with some modifications in both Greece and Egypt. Certainly there were spirit messengers who came largely in visions and in dreams. These messengers console the needy, promised relief to the desolate, and in one way or another were the invisible servants of the divine good. So the angel also shared honors with the saint as a metaphysical factor in life. Of course, perhaps even more important than the angel or the saint, however, was the prime villain of the time, the devil. And in the golden legend, he is really present almost everywhere, always. Of all the concepts that have arisen in man's mind, there is none beyond God himself, to whom as much authority has been given as to the devil. So in the stories of the golden legend, there is a certain monotony. For all the various episodes are more or less impelled by satanic intervention. Whenever anything evil was to be done, the devil was always back of it. It was the devil who hardened the hearts of Roman emperors. It was the devil who devised incredible means to torture the sanctified. So if the people of that time, simple folk that they were, had faith in good on the one hand, they had fear of evil very strongly implanted in their consciousness. The devil might appear in almost any guise. He might be a beautiful maiden leading some young swain astray. He might take the form of a beloved bishop and preach false doctrines. He might even appear to be a saint, but always somewhere there was evidence of his cloven hoof. The devil took on all kinds of forms, but always for one purpose only, to lead men away from the truth. Now this devil is likewise comparatively missing in most of the religions that led up to Christianity in the West. There were evil gods, but never did they develop such extraordinary ingenuity as after they had been Christianized. The devil took on every face and likeness. And too, the devil was blamed anything which in any way reflected against the honor of the faith. The devil was a combination of some old Jewish elements, though they were not nearly as exaggerated, and other folk beliefs and primitive faiths of people. The general tendency was, in early Christianity, to make devils out of the gods of non-Christian people. This was understandable, perhaps because of the persecutions that the early Christian community suffered. But the real devil, as he appears in the Golden Legend, is far too advanced and sophisticated a character to merely be the result of accidental selection. He was more than the building of a myth. He emerges gradually as a principle so clearly defined that he may very well be termed the adversary. This adversary plagued everyone, plagued the saints, tempted Jesus. This adversary was ever present in the medieval consciousness. It was not uncommon to carve likenesses of devils on the backs of pews to remind people of evil even while they were worshiping. It was assumed that almost all mental disease was demoniac possession, and it was treated largely by exorcism. anything that was strange or difficult or uncomfortable or unpleasant or disconcerting had an imp behind it somewhere. There was no concept among these people that they might be the devil, that their own conduct, their own attitudes might be the cause of their misfortunes. Everything that was good came from God. Everything that was bad came from the devil. And the only way to escape from evil was through the intercession of saints, or through calling upon the pious to stand as hostage for the delinquent soul. The little fragments of this show up in Egyptian mythology, but we are still dealing with something more organic, something more basic. It's almost certain from the reading of the Golden Legend that the devil is merely another version of the Indian deity Mara, or sometimes referred to as Yama. It was Mara and his host of temptations that sought to disturb Buddha at the time of the Enlightenment. It was Mara who cast the glamour of unreality upon all existence. It was Mara that was responsible for the rise of egoism in man. Thus, Mara became a symbol of mundane conditions, perhaps similar in concept to the idea that Caesar became the emblem of the false god. Caesar being merely the symbol of temporal power, of human ambition, and of the corruption resulting from selfishness. So yeah, it seemed quite reasonable that this devil that was everywhere always, it could only actually represent an attitude toward life that was essentially unreal. Our forebears in those early days did not rationalize this. But there still is abundant evidence that in their psychology, they were at least subjectively aware of this principle. They did not know the answers as we know them to some of these problems. But they were aware that the devil represented a common enemy. And they also realized that the only escape from this enemy was the constant contemplation of spiritual realities. That in the time of all emergency, man must choose between good and evil. Good represented not only by God, but his saints and his angels. Evil by the demon and his minions. And for every saintly quality, there was an infernal counterpart. And just as God ruled in the heavens, so Beelzebub, prince of the dead and of the devils, ruled in the underworld. The underworld had its equivalent of archangels and angels and saints, but they were all infernal, negative, inverted reflections of the spiritual truths. Thus, evil was good perverted. Evil was nothing more than the victory of selfishness over truth, over reality, over the divine plan of things. Men were being constantly tempted to accept false values. And these false values were finally summed up in the old virtues which the saints sought to exemplify. To escape from the devil, man had to renounce the world. It was good Hindu philosophy, good Buddhistic philosophy, good Chinese morality. The devil, therefore, became a kind of an embodied adversary. For whichever way man turned and however he tried to do good, evil was ever nigh unto him. Every force that he possessed, every faculty that existed within him, every sensory perception had two faces, a face of good and a face of evil. Use always suggested abuse.
Abuse always corrupted use. Power became the basis of persecution and tyranny. Man could never depend upon himself. Whenever he really tried to be good, the temptation to be evil was strengthened in him. His very efforts were his undoing. And he could only turn and beseech heaven to save him from this intangible mechanism that closed in upon him constantly, this misuse of his own natural powers. In the golden legend, the devil hardened the hearts of men. It is illusion, it is selfishness, it is arrogance that hardens the hearts of men. When we contradict a man, he becomes angry, not because we are wrong or he is right, but because we have contradicted him and a flare of hate arises within him. When we come to some conclusion contrary to that of our neighbor resents us. Again, it is selfishness, it is egoism that cannot bear to be corrected. It is a wise person indeed who will permit himself to be challenged without becoming angry. Everywhere in this world, as we live in it today, we can see the relentless process by which everything that we thought would accomplish good has gradually been corrupted. We see every discovery exploited. We see every invention used to hurt rather than to help. We see forever the desperate effort to profit by the labors of others. The instinct to tyrannize, to hold down, to depress. The flaring into hate which we express to anyone and against anyone who seeks to escape from the little prisons we have built for them. Thus, an ancient people, not particularly learned, not able to fully understand these things, could well assume that this adversary was real. It seemed that it operated with extraordinary cunning. It read our minds. It knew our hearts. It frustrated our steps relentlessly. The only thing they did not understand, of course, was the reason why this spirit knew so much was that this spirit was in us and knew us completely. It represented the negative polarity, the anti-self. It represented the old atavistic being, always striving to drag us back again to our own more primitive state. The devil always operated through temptation. And temptation, of course, is opportunity. And the individual who has an opportunity to profit at the expense of his ethics may very likely grasp that opportunity. Thus it is said that men sold their souls to the devil. And we have the mysterious Faustian complex in which the individual sacrifices his eternal glory for the sake of the extension of his temporal powers. Golden legend gives us this concept and places between the average person and this terrible dilemma the power of his faith, the power of the church militant, with the vision of the church triumphant. Christianity became the power that could frustrate the force of evil. It was a declaration of war against the devil. And the only way this war could be won was by leading men away from materiality. But whether it was in Asia or in the West, there's very little difference in the motivation. It was always the same, the effort to find security, serenity, spiritual strength. In the Christian martyrology, however, all these virtues were bestowed by the grace of God. It was not assumed that the individual could save himself. And this was, of course, the great line of differentiation between Eastern and Western thinking. In the West, man could not win by himself. He could only go a certain way. And even in this part of the journey, he had to receive the continuous support of guardian spirits, of venerated saints. And he had to know in a mysterious way that the very Holy Trinity itself was aware of his emergency. Thus, in the Christian version of this problem, deity also takes on a new likeness. Deity becomes the personification of principles, even as the demon becomes the personification of vice.